We have a caller on the line who wants to make a brief comment about the previous guest we had on. Caller, are you there?
Hi. Yeah, I've done some research on the internet about fuel efficiency, and for me at least, since I live in town, the most efficient vehicle would be to get an electric bicycle fitted with solid rubber tires that have little air pockets in them from one of the manufacturers that makes those. There are a couple different ones.
So it's like a sponge sort of thing?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that way, there are no flat tires ever, and they get about 15 miles of range, or 20 miles range and 15 mile an hour average. And you can put a big basket on the front and back of them.
And
they have retrofit kits where you can just buy a front wheel that has a motor in it, and then you put the battery pack in the back basket.
That cool. And then cool. The electric motor will get you up Negley Hill.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely...
Right. Well, thanks for that suggestion. Well,
why don't you, if you'd like to, we could put a link to your research on the website.
If you could send us email.
Email Bob.
Leftout.info.
Sure.
Right.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
So we have another guest. We'll talk about a slightly different topic. It's Michael Clare. Michael, are you there?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you for waiting through that last interview. Is it Michael Clare? Is that the correct pronunciation?
You got it.
Okay. He's a professor up in Amherst, Massachusetts, at several colleges. Looks like he's pretty much everywhere there.
All the Amherst area colleges.
Yeah, and he's director of a program called the Program in Peace and World Security Studies. He's written extensively on issues of the global energy economy, peace, disarmament, and many other things. So
we should mention we have links to Michael's website on the leftout.info webpage.
Yes. So the latest articles that Professor Clare has written are having to do with what's called the twilight era of petroleum. So maybe if you could just talk for a minute, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think probably many of your listeners are familiar with the concept of peak oil, meaning the moment at which the world's oil pumps, oil reservoirs, will reach their maximum sustainable output and then begin a decline. And I think we're coming to that point now. We're at the point at which we're edging slowly towards the peak of global oil production, and then it's going to level off for a while. And that's what I mean by the twilight era. Oil is not disappearing exactly. It's not the nighttime of oil yet. But it's getting dimmer, and the supply of oil around the world will not increase. And this is a dangerous moment because demand for oil around the world is increasing, not only in the United States, but also in China and India, Europe and Japan. But the oil supply is not growing, and thus you have intensified competition for what's left. And I deeply worry that this is going to lead to violent conflict, is leading to violent conflict, over the remaining supplies of oil.
Well, it certainly seems relevant to a lot of our policies in the Middle East. But let me ask you a question. I mean, on what do you base those estimates? Because in the course of my lifetime, I remember several times being told by various people involved in the politics of oil and environmentalists, for example, that we're running out of oil and there are no further supplies. And I distinctly remember in the 70s being told that certainly by now we would be all out of useful petroleum resources. And it doesn't seem to be the case. So at the moment, I feel kind of a little bit puzzled because I feel like I have a lack of what I would consider reliable information.
Sure. Bear in mind, I'm not talking about the disappearance of oil. Oil will be around for a long time to come. What I'm talking about is the gap between supply and demand. For the past 100 years or so, as demand has increased around the world, the supply has also increased because there have been incentives for oil companies to explore for new oil and bring new oil online. So you've had a more or less match between supply and demand. Now we're at a time when demand is skyrocketing because of enormous economic growth in China and India and elsewhere, but the oil companies are not reporting new discoveries. In fact, they're reporting the opposite. The giant oil companies, Chevron and ExxonMobil and Shell are all reporting the most disappointing results in exploration in decades. They're not finding new oil. So we have what's already been discovered, but it's not enough to satisfy the spurt and demand around the world, and that's why prices are so high today, because of the growing gap between supply and demand, and this is likely to continue indefinitely into the future, only to get worse and worse and worse.
So it's really a matter of the amount of oil per unit time, so to speak. How much can be pumped is what you're saying is the immediate issue.
Right. I mean, up until now, as I say, each year the world's oil supply has increased. What that means is an average, really, of all of the oil wells in the world.
Right. Okay.
More new ones have come online to replace the ones that have grown empty. But now we're at a point in time when more oil wells are emptying out than are being discovered and replaced. And this is the long-term trend that we could expect.
So I think also in response to Bob's question or comment was the Chevron ad that the article begins with. This is in the TomDispatch.com website, which I have a link to on the leftout.info page. This is a Chevron took out a big ad in New York Times and Wall Street Journal that said, basically saying the same thing, that the era of easy oil is over and that it's going to start getting tougher and tougher. And so even the oil companies are pessimistic on this question, or being honest and also being pessimistic on the question.
That's right. The central piece to this, the centerpiece, is the status of Saudi Arabia, because up until now, we've always been under the impression, or we've been led to believe, that Saudi Arabia can vastly increase its output, double, triple, quadruple its output in the future, and satisfy any imaginable level of demand. This is always what has kept us optimistic. But now, for the very first time, there's information to suggest that even Saudi Arabia cannot increase its output in the future. And if that's the case, you could kiss the petroleum era goodbye forever, because there is no other country that could replace Saudi Arabia if it runs out. And that appears to be the case of what we're looking at today.
So I was looking at some of the predictions in your article. Looks like they're listed in the article here. It says global oil prices exceeding $150 a barrel. Right now they're at something around $60. Gasoline prices of $5 per gallon or more. A spike in the consumer price index of more than 12%. A protracted recession. A decline of over 25% in the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index. A crisis between China and Taiwan, and increased friction with Saudi Arabia over U.S. policy toward Israel. Those are some of the predictions that you made in your article.
This is actually not predictions I made. I reported on a war game that was held in Washington a month ago called Oil Shockwave. This was a very high-level exercise in which former cabinet officials meant to try to figure out what the United States could do in the event of a major oil crisis. And for the purposes of this simulation, they predicted that there was a civil war in Nigeria and a major terrorist upheaval in Saudi Arabia, substantially cutting back on world oil supplies. So this was a war game, really, essentially, to see what would happen. And their conclusion was, if these events were to take place, that, as you were indicating, that we'd go into a global economic recession and face severe other effects like $150 a barrel gasoline. Now, I don't predict that those specific events will occur. I just say that in this period that we're in, it's highly likely that we'll have one crisis after another that will push up the price of oil.
We're talking to Michael Clare about the oil prospects for the future of oil, and you can give us a call at 412-268-9728. What do you think about the Bush energy bill that was just passed yesterday? You have any opinion about that? Any comments on it?
Sure. President Bush, when he signed the bill in Albuquerque yesterday, said that this was an energy plan for the 21st century. And this, in fact, is the deceit at the heart of the bill. This is really an energy bill to perpetuate the 20th century energy paradigm that we inherited when he became president of the United States in 2001.
How so?
The current energy paradigm for the United States, our current energy system, depends on fossil fuels for 90% of our energy. That's oil providing 40% of our energy, and natural gas and coal each providing another 25%. Together they provide about 90% of our energy. And these fossil fuels have two problems with them. One of them is they're finite, they're going to run out. And the second, they're the largest producers of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases that are bringing about climate change. So any rational person who cared about the future of the United States would say we have to move away from this obsolete and dangerous energy system and move as quickly as we can to a post-petroleum, post-fossil fuel energy system in the future. But what the energy bill does is provide all kinds of incentives and payoffs and benefits to big coal and big oil and big natural gas to perpetuate the existing energy paradigm rather than to move us in the direction of a new energy system.
So just to give you an example, thinking of examples of what you're saying is that things to do would be to somehow incentivize cities to control development so that development occurs closer to the center of town so the transportation needs are less.
This is one part of the picture. We in this country use petroleum mainly for transportation and mainly for ground transportation by automobiles, trucks, and buses, and all of the rest. That's mostly what we use our energy for. The United States alone uses one-fourth of the world's petroleum on a daily basis, 20 million barrels per day out of 80 million barrels per day worldwide petroleum consumption. And as I say, most of that goes for transportation. And we're building a transportation system now that, building more highways, more cars, that will demand more oil in the future, even though it appears increasingly likely that we're not going to have that oil. So what the energy bill should do is to move very swiftly to require that all cars made and sold in the United States are two or three times more fuel efficient than the vehicles we have now. But there's absolutely nothing in the energy bill that requires that. So instead, the message is go on driving your gas guzzlers.
Well, what about the provision? We were just talking with Don McKenzie from the Union of Concerned Scientists about the provision in the bill for encouraging tax breaks for purchasing hybrid vehicles.
That's a good indication of, the sort of thing that has to be done. But if you look at the Department of Energy statistics on what they predict for American car ownership, hybrids will be a tiny, tiny percent of the total automobile fleet 20 and 30 years from now. That's not good enough. We have to demand that existing automobile technology, conventional internal combustion cars, which is what Americans mainly purchase, be made far more fuel efficient than they are. You don't need hybrids to get 40 or 50 miles per gallon. You can get that with conventional cars.
By making them lighter and different materials and not requiring such huge accelerations and other changes.
Exactly.
So you're making the entirely sensible point that there's an outcome we want, and the means may or may not involve a hybrid vehicle. So somehow encouraging hybrid vehicles is not really the point.
Well, I don't want to dismiss hybrids. I own one. I think they're a great step forward. But if that's all that the bill has, we're not going to be better off 10 years from now than we are now. It has to be much more sweeping than that. And everybody who studies this comes to the same conclusion. This is not a new idea. These ideas have been around for a very long time, since the big oil crisis of 1973, when Congress first adopted the corporate average fuel efficiency standards, the CAFE standards. And they have made a difference. But now we have to go another step further in that direction, and that's what the energy bill does not include.
Yeah. So the thing that I totally agree with that everything you just said, but I also think there's something else, which I alluded to a second ago, about the sort of driving culture that exists, the fact that
Yes. We
drive too much. I mean, it would be great if we could drive cars that were five times more efficient, but we're also just driving too much. I mean, people, the suburbs are building, are being built too far away. All the malls are being built in weird suburban areas and around Pittsburgh. But you're not from here, but I mean, there's a huge mall that's called the Robinson Township that they built out there, and it's got like 100, gigantic stores, and it's like 20, 30 minutes outside of town. It's outside of Pittsburgh. I think it's insane that was even built. Like, there's all this space around here.
I mean, I don't want to talk about any specific project, but in general in the United States, you're absolutely right. And it's shocking to me that in the same day that Congress, or the same week that Congress passed this ineffective energy bill, it also passed the most expensive, bloated, disgusting, obscene highway bill in American history, hundreds of billions of dollars for new highways. That's only going to encourage more of these far-flung malls and suburbs. Entail more driving.
May jump in, Professor Clare. We're talking with Professor Michael Clare from the Five Colleges in Amherst, Massachusetts. We have a caller on the line. Donald, go ahead, please.
Yes, good evening. Two quick points, if I may. One, we will never be able to even dream up an alternative system to the petroleum-based economy, not just for America, but for the world, just strictly because of our budget crisis. We can't sit and think that just increasing miles per gallon is going to be enough. There should have been money set aside for decades for alternative fuel sources. We're not going to be able to just flip a switch.
So what is your question?
What I'm saying is that basically we're done.
Professor Clare, is it all over? Should we just give up and throw our hands up and all buy Hummers or what?
Well, let me put it this way. The Europeans are a generation ahead of us because they have made this switch 20, 30 years ago by taxing gasoline very heavily, two or three times what it is here. They've provided the pressure for people to trade in big cars for small cars, and they've invested all of that extra tax money in high-speed rail and alternative systems. That's what we're going to need. So it's true in a way what the caller says, that we're going to face a very hard time in the decades out unless we start moving now to make some of these changes.
And I would say part of that I agree with it. The other part is we're not going to be able to change, say, just for the plastics industry, as dependent as our society is on plastic alone. Once that oil's gone, you're talking about total chaos. You're not going to be able to make anything.
So that's an interesting point. Yeah. Professor Clare, what do you say about that?
Well, plastics only use a small percent of petroleum, and the fact is that petroleum will be around. We'll have some petroleum for a long time, enough to make plastics and pharmaceuticals. And in fact, I encourage setting aside the last bits of petroleum for those for the most important purposes as we move to something else. But the fact is that we waste immense amounts of petroleum every day in fuel-inefficient vehicles. If we drove cars that are twice as efficient as the ones we have now, that we would have vastly more petroleum to use for other purposes. It's the waste we have to eliminate.
And quickly, I would say, I agree with everything the professor says about this, because I look at one other thing that correlates to this in my mind, and that is if you look in the last 10 to 20 years at the defense industry, most of the weapon systems, or most weapons, I should say, that are being developed now are being developed for crowd control. If you look at Jane's Defense Weekly or whatever, any of those type of publications and individuals who look at weaponry.
So your suggestion is that people in charge know what's coming.
Oh, sure, it's coming. The only way you know that they know it's coming is if you look at the types of weapons they're developing and putting tons of money in. It all has to do with population control. So you know that they know it's coming.
All right. Thank you for your call, Donald and Professor Clare.
Oops. Sorry.
Professor Clare, are you still there? No, we lost him. Oh,
I'm sorry.
I wanted to hear his comment on that last the last comment from Donald, but that was an interesting point.
One thing I've wondered what it does touch on is, you know, how do we get there from here? The question I wanted to ask Professor Clare was, well, the standard Republican line in all of these issues is, what are you worried about? The magic of the market will take care of everything. Why do we have to do any planning whatsoever? Why do we have to consider any of these issues? Because after all, the price of oil will become really high. We'll automatically get something better and to replace it, and we'll go merrily on our way. So what is the answer to that?
The answer to that is that it's nonsense. And because we've built our way into this ridiculous lifestyle that's just completely incompatible with the world of the end of oil as the twilight era of oil. And I agree with Donald. I don't know, there's going to be a big upheaval to try to, you know, adapt to the
new thing. I think that's the catch, right? Is that, well, it may well be that in some sense you could leave it to the market, but it's a question of in the long run it may sort itself out. But as famously Keynes has said, in the long run we're all dead. So I think maybe that may be a bit of a
market doesn't look
concern.
That far in advance. No. I think that may be the big problem. It doesn't look 20 years in advance. It doesn't look ahead.
So some planning. Do we have Professor Clare back on the line?
Well, I think we may be out of time.
We're getting close to being out of time. I think we may be getting – we had a little technical problem there, and we may have Professor Clare back on. Hello, Professor Clare.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. We had a little technical problem there, and we lost you. It's our fault. My apologies. I wondered if you might respond. I'm not sure how much of the last caller's last question you heard to do with government planning for the upheavals which will ensue.
Oh, I heard that question about the investment in riot control.
Yes, okay. So I wondered if we could have...
I wouldn't say that I believe that there's anybody who's that... thought it all through quite this way. I think there is a lot of investment in crowd control for all kinds of reasons, not just
the oil,
not just energy, but all kinds of imaginable upheavals that might occur. So in that sense, I think there is a worry, but I wouldn't relate it directly to this problem.
So the question I would like to ask you to consider, what I just mentioned to Danny while we're getting you back on the line, it would be a nice way for you to finish up being on the show, is what the standard Republican line in this sort of issue would be simply to say, why are you worried about these issues? The market will take care of it itself. What is your response to that?
Well, actually, it's very interesting. The Republican right is becoming deeply divided on this particular issue. But that is to say, the question of dependency on imports. There are those Republicans who say, oh, let the market take care of it. But there are other Republicans, a growing number of them, that are saying what the market is doing is putting us in bed with the Saudi royal family, which is also in bed with all kinds of people who despise the United States, like radical Islamic fundamentalists, that we've sold our soul to the Saudi royal family, and that this is disgraceful and un-American, and we have to stop it. And the only way to stop that dependency is by the measures that I described. So I predict you'll see growing divisions within the Republicans on this issue, and in fact, the possibility where some of the Republican right will come to the same conclusions that I have about the need for energy conservation. In fact, there is a movement in this direction.
Well, thank you. Well, on that note, I think we'll wrap it up for today. Thank you, Professor Michael Clare from Five Colleges in Amherst, for appearing on Left Out. We appreciate you having you on the air.
Been my pleasure.
Thank you all for listening. This completes another show for Left Out. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Today's program was ably produced by Matt Toops, and we will be back. We'll see you in 2 weeks.